From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Coming up on today's show, how a new look at old data could change the way we eat, especially when it comes to which fats that we consider to be healthy.
There is not enough evidence to draw strong conclusions about the effects of replacing saturated fat with vegetable oil.
Then we'll talk with writer and runner Jen Miller, whose New York Times article on her weight struggle hoped to debunk the idea of a runner's body. We'll catch up with three departing dancers from the Milwaukee Ballet, all of whom are happy to have new, exciting things to move on to.
You know, a lot of times people right out of high school at 18 became professional dancers, and they danced till they were 40, and then all of a sudden they weren't dancers, and they didn't know what else they had. You know, that really was all they were.
And writer Carrie Taylor Carlson discusses her new memoir, Life on the Loose. Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. Good morning, this is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. If you are trying to eat more healthily, one of the things you might do is switch out butter for olive oil. The idea is that plant-based fats are healthier than saturated fats like lard or butter. The conventional wisdom says that saturated fats raise your cholesterol, which makes you less healthy, which will eventually end in your untimely death caused by coronary heart failure. Well, maybe not. According to a new analysis of data from the Minnesota Coronary Experiment, it seems the kind of fat you eat may have no real effect on coronary mortality. In fact, the study found that people with lower cholesterol were slightly more likely to die from heart problems. Author Daisy Zamora spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about the study and why they decided to look back at this data nearly 40 years after it was collected.
So the interesting thing about the Minnesota Coronary Experiment is that some of the key questions that were posed by the original study investigators over 40 years ago were never answered, so they were not part of the medical literature, but they're still relevant today. That includes things such as the association between changes in serum cholesterol and the risk of death, and also findings from the autopsies that they performed. And the reason they're relevant today is that as a population, our intakes of linoleic acid are a lot higher than they would be from unprocessed diets. So up to about 100 years ago, the average intake for an American was about 2 to 3% energy from linoleic acid. Now the average is about 7%. So it's a lot higher for a compound that is bioactive, has a lot of potential health effects that we know very little about.
What kind of impact did the initial Minnesota Coronary Experiment have on the way we view fat in general? What was published, you know, decades ago?
So in 1989, there was a publication that had the overall results for the cholesterol-lowering intervention versus the control group, and there were no differences in death rate. But there were other analyses that had been done. Even by that time, there is a master's thesis from 1981 that pointed to some negative effects from the intervention in some groups.
So what did your conclusion say exactly?
That there is not enough evidence to draw strong conclusions about the effects of replacing saturated fat with vegetable oils rich in linoleic acid.
One of the results that I found interesting was that you found a small correlation between linoleic acid and actually increased deaths from heart problems. Is that accurate?
Well, we found that the cholesterol lowering was associated with increased risk of death. But the results are complicated. We are not sure how to best interpret them because both the intervention and the control group increased their intake of linoleic acid to some degree.
Do we have any comprehensive studies that really show us the benefit of linoleic acid versus, you know, saturated fats? Or have we just been, you know, working off of sort of conventional wisdom that it is?
Well, as part of the paper, we included a systematic review and meta-analysis of all the similar diet heart trials that have replaced saturated fat with vegetable oils rich in linoleic acid. And there were only 5 studies. What has been viewed as proof that that replacement of saturated fat with the vegetable oils is good is a study called the Finnish Mental Health Study. We did not include that in our meta-analysis, and the reason is that that was actually not a randomized controlled trial. It was really 2 hospitals only, and everybody within the hospital received a diet, and then there was a crossover several years later. But how do you randomize only 2? So there was no real control, and within the hospital, there's always a possibility that something can be different, like one hospital may be getting better care than another hospital, or one hospital may be getting different drugs, different something. And in this case, the control group actually did get a drug that could cause adverse effects.
Okay, so it seems like a lot of these studies are actually flawed. Is most of our conventional wisdom, as it were, based on these kinds of studies?
What I can say is that the benefit of replacing saturated fat with vegetable oils rich in linoleic acid has been tested in randomized controlled trials, which are the golden standard, but none of them have actually shown that it has a benefit on coronary heart disease mortality or overall mortality.
Which is, in a lot of ways, ultimately the goal, right? You know, you eat better so you'll live longer. That's the theory. But what your study found in looking at the autopsy results and looking at that old data is that, yeah, there wasn't really a lot of correlation between the two. So we've found that eating less saturated fats leads to lower cholesterol. I mean, does lower cholesterol mean a healthier heart? Or what does that really mean for us? What does it mean for our bodies?
Well, I think that the emphasis on intermediate biomarkers, such as cholesterol, has perhaps been a little misguided in that by itself, it doesn't mean anything. So lowering cholesterol really was only important because it was thought to lower heart disease and prevent death. But if that's not the case, then there really isn't a reason to want to focus on it.
Do you think if this study had been published, you know, 3-4 decades ago, that we would have a different view of fats?
I would like to think so. I think that if the Sydney Diet Heart Study, which we recovered and analyzed in 2013, as well as the Minnesota Coronary Experiment, if both of those had been published 40 years ago, it would have helped researchers back then understand that the story about diet, cholesterol, and heart disease was not so straightforward.
How have the scientific and health-conscious communities responded to your conclusion? Because a lot of people have really hung on to this idea that, you know, plant-based fats are a lot healthier than saturated and animal fats. How have they responded?
It's been a mix. Some people have expressed a lot of interest and a lot of appreciation for the work that went into this, because it was not simply the reanalysis of the Minnesota Coronary Experiment. Like I said, we included a review and meta-analysis of other trials as well. And we also put it in the context of what we know now about the effects of linoleic acid. So as a whole, we call it a reevaluation of the traditional diet heart hypothesis as opposed to simply EMC findings. And at the same time, other people have been very vocal in stating that our findings are irrelevant and that nothing new has been added to our understanding.
How do you respond to that?
I don't think it's accurate, but I would really like to let the data speak for itself. Our manuscript is very long, very detailed. It includes the prostate thesis from 1981. It includes a detailed appendix. So, and I know it's really time consuming for anybody to go through all of that material. But I think that all the questions that have been brought up are answered in there. And it's really not about a matter of opinion. It's not that, you know, I'm advocating some truth versus another. We really just wanted to present all the information in an unbiased way.
So what kind of research would you like to see happen moving forward when we're looking at, you know, saturated fats and linoleic acid?
Well, I think that this paper really brought up a lot of questions that are not answered. And one of those of particular interest to our group is really understanding more about the health effects of linoleic acid. There are some links with chronic pain, for example, and we would like to keep working towards understanding more about its role.
All right. Well, Daisy Zamora, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect, and I look forward to hearing more of your work.
Thank you so much.
Daisy Zamora is one of the authors of Reevaluation of the Traditional Diet Heart Hypothesis, Analysis of Recovered Data from the Minnesota Coronary Experiment. She spoke with Joy Powers. For more information about the study, head to WUWM.com. Coming up next, how one woman did lose weight in part by eating full-fat foods. We'll talk with her next on Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. We go a little farther afield for this month's Fit for You segment. New Jersey-based freelance writer and runner Jen Miller wrote an article for the New York Times last fall that described her journey through weight gain and loss, all the while she was competing in marathons. The article was shared across social media and continues to prompt discussion about what a healthy body looks like. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski reached Miller on Skype to ask her about the story and why it's so important to shatter the myth of the perfect runner's body.
In 2013, I ran the New Jersey Marathon, and I ran well, but I hurt my foot, and I was out of running for some time. I nearly broke my foot, so of course, you're going to have to take some time off. So I wasn't really able to run again seriously for almost a year. I did a half marathon in the fall, but I really didn't start cranking up again for almost a year, and I kept eating like I was running all the time, and I was sort of working through some stuff in my personal life that I was unhappy about. I work from home, so I don't wear pants that have a drawstring. I didn't realize how high I'd gotten until I went to the doctor and I got weighed, and I realized I was getting close to overweight because I don't keep a scale in my house, so I wasn't really keeping track of it. So then I realized, oh, I'm there, but I'm still running marathons. So I was still running. I wasn't running as well, but I was still doing all this stuff. And when you're training for a marathon, it's really hard to diet, quote unquote, because you're so hungry all the time. And I wasn't paying enough attention to what I was eating. I was just eating whatever I felt like eating. And in any context, no matter whether you're, you know, you walk your dog twice a day or you're running 10, 11, 12 hours a week, that doesn't work out. The calories never balance themselves if you're eating more than you're burning. And that's pretty much what happened.
So you mentioned you don't keep a scale in your house. How did you come to decide that?
I wrote this memoir called Running a Love Story that was published in March, and that chronicled some earlier issues that I had with food, starting when I was in a sorority in Florida. Not that it was the sorority's fault, but it was a high concentration of women in a state where people are pretty naked most of the time.
Right.
So there was pressure in that sort of circumstance to be small, and my tactic about it was to just not eat a lot of food. I would try to go as long as possible during the day and not eat anything, which is totally unhealthy and awful. And then I got into a relationship in my 20s with someone who had a drinking problem. And he tried to get me to be as tiny as possible. And I ate less. And sometimes I would binge and throw up. So after I found running after that relationship and started running more, I said, I need to get better with food. And got rid of the scale after that because I didn't want to micromanage my life. So when I hit 165 on the scale and I decided to make a change, I didn't just rely on every time I had to go to the doctor. I bought a scale and decided to weigh myself every Wednesday when I woke up, and I still do that now.
So you mentioned your relationship with food changing before running and then after running. And most of the population that works out were amateur athletes, and we don't have a nutritionist on call and prepared meals for us. So how rigid are you now with meal planning and the types of food you eat after you've lost this weight that you gained?
Well, I did just finish my sixth marathon. So towards the end of that, I wasn't as good with the food as I usually am, but I was much more conscious in this training cycle of what I was eating and what I needed to do. I follow The Rock on Instagram. This will go somewhere, I promise. And he recently said that he needs to go from being in shape for the movie Baywatch, which was very lean, to being like a monster for the next Fast and Furious. So I've sort of taken that approach, not to being a monster. but marathon shape is one thing, but when I want to do a road mile, which is what that article you're referencing is about, I'm much more careful about what I eat. Fortunately, the road mile that I run is in September, and that means I can eat the best of Jersey fresh produce all summer. So that means that eating healthier doesn't taste bad. That sounds pretty cheesy, but it's just, it's easier than when I have to rely on a conventional grocery store. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And I'm not strict at all. I have a general outline of what I eat when I'm trying to do this and get, you know, muscle tone and all that. The story actually was published in October, but the New York Times keeps sponsoring it on Facebook. And I know when it does it, because I get a whole fresh batch of emails. People wanted to know exactly what I ate. They wanted to know my meal plan, my calorie count. One person demanded to know whether or not I ate sweet potatoes. And I don't like sweet potatoes. So it was like not a question that applied to me. Mm-hmm. I was never that strict with it, because when I get that strict with it, I get insane with it. And then I tip into unhealthy eating. Right. So it's just a general outline that I try to follow. And if I don't, you know, life moves on.
With meal planning, and there's obviously, as you know, a plethora of articles out there that say, you know, here's a magic formula, here's a calorie calculator. It's a lot of information that can be overwhelming for many people trying to make a magic formula to lose weight or to fuel their exercise in a better way. Do you think too much information is the problem nowadays that can cause bad eating habits, not necessarily starving oneself, but crazy limiting? What's your advice to people to try and find their meals that work for them and their bodies?
Know that there is no magic formula. You have to try stuff out to see what works for you. And please don't follow the latest hot trend. I had a lot of people email like, oh, this is paleo or this is gluten-free. I'm like, no. I don't pay attention to any of that sort of stuff. I try to eat whole food that hasn't been processed a lot. That's not unprocessed food, food that hasn't been processed a lot. Because even yogurt could be considered processed food if you think about it. Try stuff out that works for you. This works for me. Two different diets work for me in two different settings of physical activity. They're not going to work for everybody. You know, I don't make money from running. Sometimes I win like a trophy and a $25 gift certificate. I make my money writing. So I am not going to sacrifice all that much in my life to be as tiny and as in best shape as I can possibly be. So that's part of it too. Does that make any sense? Am I rambling too much?
No, that absolutely makes sense. I think also what you're going along the lines of is the mindset is all that it's about. And you train and ran for two marathons at your heaviest. And you mentioned in the article, you're obviously dissatisfied with the time you finished them in. But nonetheless, it was completing marathons nonetheless, you know, a feat that many people find incredibly daunting. But are these races tainted for you because of the weight increase?
No, absolutely not. One of the races was extremely hilly and I hadn't trained for the hills. So there was that. And then, the second one was the New York City Marathon in 2014. And I have, severe eczema and I ended up having an outbreak before the race and I was on a lot of drugs and not the fun kind. So there was that going into it. And I think the New York City Marathon was the hardest race I ever had. And sometimes when things are not going well, whether it's in a run or it's in life or something, I think about how I still managed to cross that finish line, feeling out of shape, not feeling great. The weather was not the best conditions. So I sort of keep that as something, if you can do that, then you can do this. There's a picture of me in the New York City Marathon in 2014 that ran with the story next to me running the 2015 Fifth Avenue Mile. And I didn't notice how big of a difference there was. You know, I felt it in my clothes and the way I looked, I didn't realize how much of a difference there was until I saw those pictures put next to each other by the New York Times. So I think it's important to have that record. And I also think it's important to know that there was nothing wrong with 165 pounds. Absolutely nothing. I was healthy. I was running marathons, as you said. My doctor said I was great, but I didn't feel comfortable at that weight. And it was about feeling comfortable in your own skin and feeling like yourself again. So there was nothing wrong with that picture. There was nothing wrong with those races, except that the times were slower than I wanted them to be. But it is nice to have that photo to remember what it was like to train at a heavier weight and how much better it is to not.
Right. And also along those lines, you mentioned that you felt a little bit less of a feminist because you encouraged like all women's bodies, any shape or size are beautiful, yet you felt that guilt associated with the weight gain once you were in that doctor's office. Do you still battle with that doubt? And what do you think the message women should be receiving, especially from other women athletes?
That is the doubt that kept me from almost not writing the story. I had talked to my editor about it. I've written for this editor for, at that point, about 5 years. And I said, I think that there's a story here. However, I really don't know if I should even touch the issue of weight because it is such a sensitive topic. And he said, I think you can do this. Take your time with it. And I think I wrote it in like 2 weeks or something. My opinion hasn't changed. The response to that story has been so overwhelming that I'm glad that I wrote it. I don't feel like a bad feminist. A lot of people have asked me to expand on that topic, but I think what I said in the piece was enough. I think it's worth saying there's nothing wrong with how you want to look, but for me, this was bad and I wanted to make a change because I was unhappy in other areas of my life too that was making me lazy about eating, and it bothered me. It personally bothered me, but I didn't want my opinion of that to make somebody else feel bad. So I totally agree with body acceptance, and whatever you feel good at is great. If there's something about your appearance that is bothering you, let me try that again. I'm sorry. This is a complicated thing.
No worries. Do you want me to ask the question again?
Yeah, go ahead. I'm so sorry.
No, not a problem at all.
Okay.
All right. I'll just take it from the top of that.
Okay. All right. Let's go.
Let's try this again. You mentioned in your article that it's your strong belief that women of all shapes and sizes are beautiful, yet you felt less of a feminist or you felt guilty about your body and weight gain once you hit that number at the doctor's office. So do you still battle with this doubt? And what message should women be receiving from other females especially?
So the concern about this almost kept me from writing the story because I know I have friends who are 165 pounds and they look great and they don't have a problem with it, or they feel bad about it and I don't think that they should. So I didn't want to shame anybody, even if the number was not 165, just saying, well, I'm heavier than that or I'm less than that. I needed to use the number in order to get the story across. And I told my editor, I said, I don't know if I want to touch anything about weight because it's such a sensitive topic. And we're all so different, but there's BMIs and all this stuff that might say that I'm healthy and somebody else is not. And it's just very complicated. It's a very complicated emotional issue for a lot of people in this country. And the way that women are judged for how they look is a whole big other bucket of stuff. And I didn't even know if I wanted to kick that bucket and see what was in there. And, you know, it became a feminist thing because it wasn't really about what anybody else saw me as at 140 pounds versus 165 pounds, it's how I felt as an amateur athlete at either weight. And that was the point. I was unhappy with some stuff in my life. And one of the results of that was that I was not paying attention to what I was eating. I was not eating the right foods that would have fueled me as an athlete. And I wanted to change that. So it was about what I wanted to do, not what anyone else told me to do. Because, oh boy, let me tell you, a lot of people had an opinion about my appearance after that story ran. There were some people who told me I was still fat at 140 pounds that I looked skeletal at 140 pounds. And I just, you know, that's not the point. That's not the point. But, you know, you can't argue with commenters, and they're going to take what you say and filter it through themselves however they want to. But I should accept my body at any weight, shape, or size in theory. However, I want to run faster, so that's why I did it.
How important is time and pace to you in the sport? And did the weight loss center on improving your time? And do you feel it that it perhaps can keep a constant unhealthy pressure on runners to always improve your time and run faster and push harder?
I think it depends, and that's kind of a cop-out. It depends on what you're doing. So the 2016 New Jersey just ran on May 1st. I wanted to break my previous personal record. There were decisions I made to reach that goal. How much sleep did I get? Do I take a nap today? Do I have this much coffee? Do I go out tonight? Do I consume alcohol? That was all in the goal of wanting to set a new personal record in the marathon. And it was something I did for 18 weeks and then it was over. So the rest of the year, you know, I'm going to run a firecracker 5K and run next to my friend who's running her first 5K. Every race has a different purpose and you just have to figure out what it is. If every single race you ever do is to PR every single time, that might be unhealthy. Because then you might be missing the point of the sport, which it's a very communal sport. I think if you're always, I mean, it's like with anything, if you're obsessed on performing perfectly at every single opportunity and don't think about the other reasons why you're running, it can be unhealthy. I think that's true.
Running, as you mentioned, is a communal sport, yet also solitary at the same time in that you're competing with yourself and setting your own goals. But what is it about running that has kept you so diligent to the sport? How did you get into it after your personal struggles? What made you want to hit the pavement?
So my first 5K I ran almost 10 years ago because a magazine paid me $750 to and write about it. And I was a baby freelance writer at the time. And I thought, well, this is a great reason to run because I hated running before. I played soccer and softball in high school, and you only ran as punishment. So why would I just run for the sake of running? But that was why they gave me the assignment. Like, well, you hate running, so this will be a funny story. So I ran that 5K, and then I kept running in my repertoire of physical activity. And then three things happened in quick succession. The boyfriend I had at the time, who was an alcoholic and very unhealthy for me, broke up with me. He held my hand and said, I'll keep you in the top 8 of my MySpace friends. So that was nice. So three things happened in a row. My boyfriend at the time, who was an alcoholic and not very nice to me, broke up with me. Then my grandfather died. And then I decided to buy a house right before the recession hit. So being self-employed, I not only owned a house that wasn't worth what I paid for it, I also lost half my clients. So things were bad. So I decided to run a 10-mile road race. And that's really how I got into it, not just for the physical, but for the mental. It's really helped deal with the worst chunk of my life. But also I use it every day now as sort of a moderator to the day. So I just put an offer in on a house today.
Oh, hooray.
Congrats. Yeah, a new house.
Excellent.
Another house, not the one I own now.
Mm-hmm.
But that's very stressful, especially because it's, we're going to take your best offer and that's it. So I don't know. What do I bid? What do I do this? Do I offer this? Do I do that? So then I went out and I took a slow run, fast hike after, mm-hmm. because I'm still recovering from the marathon. And I felt so much better after. So it's become part of my life that just makes everything seem better. I don't know. Even when things are bad, I can still go out and run or take that fast hike because my legs are still beat up from setting my personal record and feel just a little bit better.
Well, thank you for opening up your running life and your personal life and writing this article and kind of dispelling the myth of a runner's body and the struggles we all go through.
Sure. Thank you for letting me talk about it more.
Jen Miller is a freelance writer based in New Jersey. There's a link to her New York Times article, Crossing the Finish Line 25 Pounds Lighter, at WUWM.com. You can also hear our expanded conversation with her there as well. Miller spoke with Audrey Nowakowski. Coming up next, we'll chat with three members of the Milwaukee Ballet who are leaving after this weekend's performances of Alice in Wonderland. Lake Effect returns with that conversation in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. As Benjamin Franklin famously wrote, nothing is certain except death and taxes. However, you could probably add a third certainty to that list, and that is change. The Milwaukee Ballet, which tonight opens its final show of the season, Alice in Wonderland, is undergoing some big changes. Once the curtain comes down on Alice after the Sunday performance, lead artist Mark Petrocci will retire after 13 seasons with the ballet, and artists Susan Gartel and Valerie Harmon will move on to other artistic adventures. They'll all be missed. I met with the three dancers recently during a rehearsal break at the ballet headquarters on the corner of 5th and National. Well, thank you all so much for joining me on your lunch break here at the home of the Milwaukee Ballet. I really appreciate your time.
It's our pleasure.
No problem.
Yeah, our pleasure.
So this is a year of big changes for all of you. This is a last performance for all of you after now 13 years for you two, is that right?
That's
and
correct.
10 for you. So what does it feel like? Let's start there. I mean, knowing that this is the last time you'll be dancing here. Susan, do you want to start?
Sure. It's kind of bittersweet. I have a huge culmination that Sunday. I actually graduate from college. I'm walking. I have my graduation ceremony at 9 a.m. that morning, and then I have my final show with Milwaukee Ballet at 1:30 that afternoon. So I think
is there champagne after that?
I will be drinking champagne, I think, for the next 3 days. But it's hard to imagine. I haven't really. People keep asking how I'm doing, and I can't really imagine my life without Milwaukee Ballet. It's been so long, so I don't think it will sink in until the fall when we would go back. But I'm grateful for the 13 years I have, and I'm sure it'll be a day full of emotion. I mean, happiness and sadness of saying goodbye to a lot of people that I love, and the Milwaukee audience. You know, the Marcus Center. I've done so much on that stage that it will be hard to say goodbye.
What about dance itself?
I don't plan on retiring from dance itself, so I'm not quite sure what the world has in store for me. Little doors keep opening, so we'll see what path I'm led down. But leaving just this company will be a big deal for me.
And Mark, for you too, because you're moving on to something completely new too. You just got a degree as well.
Not quite yet. I have about 1 year left in the economics department at UWM. But I echo a lot of what Susan said, that while I've been preparing myself for this for a number of weeks now, I'm not certain how I'm going to feel on that day. I know that I do feel extremely strong about my choice to retire from classical dance. It's something that, like any of us will tell you, you have to give it the right amount of weight to make that decision. But I feel incredibly excited about the new adventures that lie ahead, and the opportunity to say goodbye with such a great production. And I really do feel
and
excited.
All what, six parts you're dancing?
There are quite a few. Yeah. I feel particularly fortunate to be playing both the March Hare and Tweedledee in the Tea Party. You know, the quintessential Tea Party with the Mad Hatter. It's a great piece within the ballet, and then I get to do a rather nice duet with Garrett Glassman as Tweedledee and Tweedledum at the end.
Now, Valerie, for you, it's the end here, but you're moving on to more dance.
That's correct, and I think Susan put it so well. As far as leaving here, it's really bittersweet. This place has been a home growing up through MB2, and then transitioning into the company. I've learned so much, made so many great friendships, and really just been in an environment where we're learning a lot from each other and pushing each other and growing all the time. So I'll be moving into a new environment and different challenges, more new things, but I'm excited, a little scared, but I think that comes with any transition, and it's really hard to think of what the last performance here will feel like. Again, it's exciting to share the stage with some of the people that are closest to me and who have been a part of all my time here. But I'm excited for the next step, and it'll just be all new things.
What were you looking for? Were you looking to move somewhere else? Was this part of, you know, the professional trajectory that you needed to go somewhere else and do new things?
Yeah, definitely. It's always a challenging thing as a dancer, realizing how short your career is. And I think for me, that realization didn't start coming up till a couple years ago. And I've gotten so many great opportunities here, but in watching people that I really respected retire or move on and realizing, well, they're not really that much older than me, I really had to take a look at how I wanted to still grow or if there were new things I wanted to try. And again, it's the short life of the profession that I felt like I owed it to myself to try and just step outside of what was comfortable for me and push the limits a little bit more.
Yeah, I think a lot of us who aren't in the profession are so surprised by how few years you really have. I mean, the outliers like Baryshnikov are really the exception. You know, most people are not dancing that long at that caliber. And, you know, and so you really have a very, very short, you're compressing everything into what, a decade maybe?
Maybe 2 decades if you're lucky. Especially American dancers, our seasons are short. You know, in Europe, they have year-round contracts and we have 31 weeks. So even, you know, you maybe have 10 years or 15 years, and of that you have 8 months of those years. So you really have to listen to your body, listen to yourself, and keep listening to that little voice that's telling you to push harder, to challenge yourself, because you owe it to yourself. You've worked your whole life to get to this point, and you don't want to look back on your career and wish you could have done that one role or would have moved to a different company, or and everyone's different, but you really have to listen to see what's best for you. Because it is a really short profession, so you have to be a bit selfish with your time.
Well, and like you were saying, it's with that shortness, it's compressed, but then you have to look ahead because you've got so much of your working and productive life ahead of you, you know, that most of us, you know, are settled into one, maybe two careers in our lives, and you're almost starting over.
You know, most people kind of get tied up with their identity and their profession, but we've been doing this since we were 6 years old. And I think that something that's happened recently, which I think the three of us are examples of, are, you know, a lot of times people right out of high school at 18 became professional dancers and they danced till they were 40, and then all of a sudden they weren't dancers and they didn't know what else they had. You know, that really was all they were. And I think that if you don't prepare yourself mentally for that, I think I'll have to mourn that when I do retire completely, because that is a loss. I'm no longer Susan, a dancer, and I don't know what that feels like or what that will feel like, but it's a reality of when, you know, because it's an inevitable thing. So I think that we have been lucky that we've been able to kind of face that and prepare for that, even though, yeah, we can't guess how that will feel, because it is a very big part of who we are. But I think once a dancer, always a dancer, deep down.
Yeah, and I think it sounds like you had, what you were saying, Mark, you had the space to be able to look ahead without fearing that you're going to lose your job, mm-hmm. because you were looking ahead and realizing this is a very real thing. You know, your body lasts so long, you mm-hmm. know, and that you have to move on. And what you were saying, Susan, about, you know, people come to the end of their career and then they don't know who they are. I mean, that's true elsewhere. Yours is just, again, so much more concentrated.
Yeah.
And you started so young.
Yeah.
You know, most of us don't know we're going to do that.
It's the one constant of our lives, you know, right. for most of us. It's the thing that we can remember. We did Nutcracker when we were 5. So it's the thing that I can't think of, they don't have memories without ballet in it. And that's a strange thing, you know.
Yeah. Or that our year takes on markers, mm-hmm. you know, with relation to when we were students, you know, different periods, whether it was examinations or being in Nutcracker, what that was like, and then moving into a company and then the rhythm of the company. And you start essentially putting markers within each year of things that are related to dance. So all those markers then, it's not that they disappear, they get transformed, and different things take on significance as you move away from, or I anticipate, you know, I don't know yet, obviously,
right.
but I'm anticipating that will be the case.
Yeah, we're talking ahead of the
right.
game here.
Yeah.
It hasn't
exactly.
quite come to an end.
No.
And certainly for you, of course, it hasn't. Do you know what you're going to do in your new season yet? Have you auditioned for roles?
I know they'll be doing several mixed programs, so I don't know all of the specifics of it yet, but I know that if I wanted to seek something different, I really wanted it to be different, because, like I said, there's so many great things that I've learned here and have used to feed my career, but now I need to explore the other side, too.
Sure. Yeah, it makes sense. will the two of you come back and visit? Or is that too difficult to do?
No, I hope to come back and visit. There's weddings and babies, and you know, I've grown up here with most of these people. I think I spent most of, you know, half of my life here, you know, really formative years. So I hope to come back and see people. I don't know how often it will be, realistically, but I can't imagine not coming back for visits now and then.
And Valerie, even though you're going to be performing a lot more.
Oh, absolutely. There's, you know, this place was so important to my life for the last 10 years, and I still have family close by and really good friends. There's amazing people, and this, just because this has been such a place of growth and learning about myself and a big part of my dance career, I'll always look forward to coming back.
And Mark?
And I will actually not be that far away. Myself and my wife, Courtney Kramer Petrocci, formerly of the company, will be moving to Crystal Lake, Illinois, where she has taken up the artistic directorship of a school called the Summers Dance Academy. And I will be commuting 2 days a week up to UWM to finish off my degree. I'll be around. Yeah.
Yes, you're not going too far.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Well, I want to thank all of you for all of the wonderful, you know, performances that we've been graced with all of the time that you've been here, you know, standing in for the audience out there. Thank you for that. And thank you on a small scale for just taking some time and talking with me just a little bit.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Milwaukee Ballet leading artist Mark Petrocci, along with artists Susan Gartell and Valerie Harmon. This weekend's performances of Alice in Wonderland at the Marcus Center are the final appearances all three dancers will make with the company. Petrocci is retiring after 13 seasons with the ballet, and Gartell and Harmon are leaving to explore other artistic pursuits. There is more information about them and about Alice in Wonderland at WUWM.com. We'll take one last break and then be back with a conversation with Lake Effect essayist and now memoirist Carrie Taylor Carlson ahead of her appearance at Boswell Book Company this coming Sunday. You are listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North. Author Carrie Taylor Carlson really knows the meaning of fake it till you make it. The former suburban housewife turned wilderness guide spent a lot of time smiling through the fear as she started her outdoor touring business, Venture West. Taylor Carlson has previously shared some of her experiences with Venture West as a Lake Effect essayist. Well, she's also a local food critic who's published several guides about food and travel in Milwaukee. And in her new memoir, Life on the Loose, My Journey from Suburban Housewife to Outdoor Guide, she shares a new side of herself. The book is a candid look at her personal struggle to mount her own business during a rough divorce and learning about what it takes to survive in the wilderness. Taylor Carlson sat down with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and started out by analyzing how Life on the Loose differs from her previous work.
Well, first of all, you know, I guess I would consider it a memoir. And I worked on it for a long time, maybe 5, 6, 7 years. And I had a lot of help from my friends. I had a lot of critiques at Redbird, Red Oak Studios. And it was hard. Part of the problem was that I didn't keep a journal all those years that I was running trips. I ran trips for 32 years. And so I was relying on my memory. And as I was writing the book, I kept adding things. I'd write a chapter, and then I'd read it, and then I'd think, oh, then three more things happened. And then I'd go back and I'd revise. So it was a long process, but it was really fun. And it brought back just so many, many memories of the good times that we had on those trips.
You know, you share a lot of yourself in the book, and I could see that writing maybe parts of this would have been emotionally straining because of the topics that you touch on. You know, how did writing this piece make you feel?
Well, actually, it made me feel pretty good. I mean, it did. It was, in the beginning, okay, so I mean, you might be referring to the fact that in the first few chapters of the book, I do talk about the fact that I was going through a divorce. And the divorce was already in process when I started the business. My passion for my business did not cause the divorce. But since it took us 8 years from start to finish, there was a lot of trauma that went along with my starting the business and then the things that happened with the family. And I felt that I didn't really choose to include that, but I got so much feedback from people that said, Carrie, people really want to know about you and they want to know who you are. And so I started adding that in. But that's one of the things that I went back and added, because in the beginning, it was just me strictly telling Venture West stories. And probably the last third or half of the book is more Venture West stories than my personal life, but there's a lot of both in it.
Yeah, delving in, that is what I was talking about, by the way.
I figured.
and delving into those kinds of relationships can be kind of hard. I mean, was it difficult to share those parts of yourself?
It was a little uncomfortable. It brought back a lot of memories, and there are other things that I just didn't share that I thought I would rather keep private. I pretty much left my children out of it. My youngest was 12 when I started the business, I think. Let's see. Yeah, he was 12 when I started it. My oldest was 18. I have four children. And those first 3 or 4 years, I just ran a few weekend trips, so I didn't really feel that I was interfering much with the family life. And then in 1986, so then my youngest would have been 16, that was the first time I actually ran a trip out west. I took a group backpacking in the Three Sisters Wilderness in Oregon. And that's when the business started to take off. But by that time, you know, the two younger ones were in high school and almost ready to go off to college. And my two older ones were, you know, finishing college and going off into their own lives. And so then I felt that it was okay to start running a lot of trips and being at home less. And I was fortunate in that my ex-husband, after we divorced, was always willing to move back into the house and take care of the kids while I was gone. That was a real blessing for me. I don't think I could have done it if he hadn't been willing to do that.
So I think when we picture sort of an outdoor guide, we think of maybe, you know, a rugged young man who has been living in the woods his entire life and was more or less raised by wolves. But that's definitely not your story. And your journey to becoming an outdoor guide seems pretty unusual. You know, without giving too much of the book away, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, last weekend, I ran into somebody who was in my Girl Scout troop when one of my daughters was in grade school. And as I was talking to her, I realized that and this is not in the book, so I'm not giving anything away. I realized that probably being a Girl Scout leader and taking those kids camping 3, 4, 5 times a year for 3 years had a lot to do with the fact that I had the courage to take people out and masquerade as a guide. And I'll say in the beginning, I was truly masquerading. I had absolutely no clue what I was doing. But somehow I pulled it off and found out that it gave me a tremendous amount of joy to take people outdoors and to not only recharge their batteries, but to recharge my batteries. Because out in nature, out in wild places, in the wilderness, that's my safe place. That's where I like to be.
Something you do mention in the book is sort of your love of reading about the outdoors, reading about other people's journeys, going into the wilderness, as it were. What was the moment when you said, I don't want to read it on the page anymore. I want to do it. I want to be that person.
Boy, I don't know. Gail Sheehy wrote a book called Passages back in the 80s. And she wrote about somebody in San Francisco. Oh, this was such a long time ago. And this woman would just take people out in the hills, in the mountains, well, more hills, I guess, around San Francisco, and just do day hikes with them. And I remember reading that and thinking, I want to be that person. I want to be the person who has people following along behind her, taking them out to beautiful places. And that had a lot to do with also with why I started the business, because I was fascinated by that. And I thought, well, maybe I can do that. And maybe I can just start small, although I actually started with a 4-day backpacking trip, so I didn't start that small. But it worked. I took people up to Pictured Rocks, and nobody got hurt, and everybody had a good time. And I thought, oh, I can do this.
So how do you think your customers are going to feel about reading this book?
Oh, that's a good question. I have gotten some feedback. To be honest, they love it. And I just today got in the mail a long letter from somebody who lives in Colorado now who took a lot of my trips. I actually mention her in the acknowledgments as one of the people who took more than 8 trips. And she wrote like little 3-sentence reminders of each of the trips that she took with me. And she loved them. And she said, I wish I'd taken more. And she loved reading the book. And she was surprised at how candid I was and how honest I was in the things that I revealed. So I think that's what I've heard from other people, too. They're surprised that I was so candid in the way I told my stories, because I didn't hold much back.
It is a very honest book. You start off by, not to be too candid myself, you are getting sick on a boat, and that's the first image we get as you of you as the narrator.
Oh, yeah.
Why did you start with that story?
Why did I start with that story? I thought it made a good story, and it was true. I mean, that was the prologue. That wasn't the first trip. That was a trip I took to Isle Royale, and that was in the early years, because I still have a couple of friends from that trip. We were all, throwing up off that boat. But I do remember thinking, and I wrote this in the book, if this is adventure travel, I should rather just stay home and do my laundry. Because I was sick as a dog, and I was sick for that whole trip. I get motion sick, and it took me maybe 2 weeks to get over it.
Well, I love the book.
Thank you.
I'm excited for you to share it with the world. And Carrie Taylor Carlson, thank you so much for joining us here in studio.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed it.
Carrie Taylor Carlson is a Lake Effect essayist, local food critic, and former outdoor guide with her business, Venture West. Taylor Carlson will be at Boswell Books this Sunday in support of her new memoir, Life on the Loose, My Journey from Suburban Housewife to Outdoor Guide. For more information, go to WUWM.com. And that wraps up another edition of Lake Effect. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie North. I hope you will be back with us tomorrow at 10 for the next episode of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Right now it's 11 o'clock, and continue to stay tuned because Fresh Air is next.